Thank you for listening to Torah Media Atlanta. Won't you consider making a donation to help support this important work? Just go to TorahMediaAtlanta.com and click on the donate link. Thank you very much.
Okay, beginning chapter 33. Okay, so we've been through this a couple of times. We're not going to go through the verses. Again, just to fill ourselves in, catch ourselves up. We are up to the second part, the back half of the last episode of Yaakov and Esav, which they've actually met. The first part, chapter 32, was Yaakov preparing for the meeting, separating the camp, his prayer, his actual battle with the angel, and the prohibition of eating the Gid Hanasha. Chapter 33 begins with the actual meeting, Esav's request, let's walk together, and Yaakov rejecting that and them going their own separate ways. And so now we're going to go through this chapter again. We did it with Rashi and Ramban. We'll now do it with the commentary of Rav Hirsch. Vayisa Yaakov Einov, beginning chapter 33. Yaakov lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, Esav was coming, and with him 400 men. So he divided the children unto Leah, unto Rachel, and unto the two handmaids. Rav Hirsch comments, he saw Esav not disarmed by the gifts. He had not disbanded his troops. So he divided. Meaning to say, again, Rav Hirsch is picking up, we, the reader, sort of have been through the story before, but if you're Yaakov, if you remember, he sends the gifts. First, he sends a message to his brother, I'm coming. And the response that he gets back is, he's coming with 400 men. If you remember the Ramban we saw last week, gave us two options. When the men came back and said, he's coming with 400 men, they either said, and he didn't even accept us. He didn't even accept our gifts. He just didn't want to hear us at all. Or that he did, but he's still coming with his soul. So there are two options as to whether or not he even received the gifts. So, first comments here, so Yaakov lifts up his eyes and he sees, whichever way that went, it had no impact. Because the 400 men that he left with are now still coming, despite the fact that he sent a pretty enormous gift to his brother. Says Rav Hirsch, as our sages take this whole story as being the program for our behavior towards our Esavs. This is a concept we've mentioned many times, that the sages see in this entire episode of Yaakov and Esav teaching us how to behave to our Western exile that we're in, how to behave towards the Esavs that we interact with. So we learn from here that though we are filled with confidence in God and His promises, we still have to do all we possibly can do ourselves. Based on the language the Gemara uses, Ein somchen al hanes. We do not rely upon miracles. And therefore, it first points out, look at what the Chumash says. Yaakov looks up. He sees his brother coming. He sees he's coming with 400 men. What's his immediate response? He divides up his camp again. Separates the men, the women, the maidservants. Why didn't he start? He did daven. He took care of the gift. And now he needs to do what he needs to do. You live in a world and you do not rely upon a miracle. That's not the Jewish response. You do that which is necessary from our own perspective down here to be able to get ourselves ready for battle. Vayosem, verse 2. Es hashvachos v'asyalde henri shona. He put the handmaids and their children foremost. Then he put Leah and her children after that. And then in the back was Rachel and her son Yosef. It is possible in verse 2, Rav Hirsch says that his feelings and greater affection directed this order. So, on the one hand, you can say he did that because of his hierarchy of likes. That he put the maidservant, he liked them all, but someone's got to be the most and someone's got to be the least. So he put the maidservants first, and then Leah, and then Rachel in the back. Leah was clearly his wife of choice, his most beloved. So it says Rav Hirsch, it could be that that's what he was doing.
Rachel.
You said backwards. Rachel was his wife of choice. It could be that that's what he was thinking, and we will look at it on that level. I believe Rashi even made that comment that Acharon Chaviv, that his most dear was last. But, says Rav Hirsch, but it is by no means necessary to assume that this was the reason for it. And we'll get to that in verses 6 and 7. We'll see what Rav Hirsch believes is an even more probable cause for why he put the maidservants first, then Leah, then Rachel. And again, I just want to stress, if you were to look at that order and you say, why did he do that? I think the gut reaction that most people would have would be, maidservants first. Again, I don't like the terminology of least liked. It's like everybody was liked, but it's just, that would be first. And Rachel, which was his prized wife, would be last. Says Rav Hirsch, just hang on to verse 6 and verse 7. I'm going to give you another approach, which I think is even more probable as to why the order was as it was. Even though he adds, it certainly was possible that it was simply that you know, who is my most prized and precious possession going last. Verse 3 and 4 quickly. Who of our lefneim? Then he himself passed before them, so that Yaakov is now leading the charge before the maidservants Leah and then Rachel. He bowed himself to the ground 7 times until he came near to his brother. And then he approaches, as we've seen, with the 7 prostrations as he gets closer, constantly in a sign of humility. And then we get to now verse 4, Esav's response. Again, we're moving sort of quickly because we've seen this before. What's Esav's response to this? He's now received a message that Yaakov is coming, which he responded to by sending 400 men. Then he receives massive gifts, which we don't know how he's responded to. Ramban tells us either he rejected them or he took them. We don't know what. And now he sees his brother, and his brother approaches him with prostration 7 times as he gets closer. Then what does Esav do, says the Torah? Vayoras Esav lekros. So he ran to meet him. Vayichabkehu, he embraced and hugged him. Vayipol al tzavarav, he fell upon him. Vayishakehu, and he kissed him. Vayizku, and then they wept. Says Rav Hirsch in verse 4, that here purely humane feelings overcame Esav is warranted for by the little word Vayivku, and they wept. You want to know how Esav was feeling emotionally? Where was he in this? Says Rav Hirsch, it's in that last word that tells you what was going on. Vayivku, and he cried. Says Rav Hirsch, a kiss can be false. Kiss doesn't mean anything. But tears are different. But not tears that flow at such moments. When tears flow at that moment, then you have an expression of the soul. Bacha, the root of the word to cry is related to bacha or pakach, to burst out. Tears are drops from one's innermost soul. A common idea that many commentators like to talk about, the idea of crying. The sweat of the soul, the emotion of the soul. You really know what's going on inside when you see what moves a person, what brings them to tears. Says Rav Hirsch, the kiss, this kiss, and these tears show us that Esav was also a descendant of Avraham. We've spoken, Esav, Rav Hirsch himself has spoken a lot about this as we've gone through these stories at the beginning of Chumash, how Avraham has 2 children, Yitzchak and Yishmael. And then Yitzchak is the one that's chosen, and then Yitzchak has 2 children, Yaakov and Esav, and Yaakov is the one that's chosen, and he has 12, and all of his children are chosen. But Rav Hirsch talks about how each one of the previous generations, the previous fathers, had actually 2 children, one who was in and one who was out. But the one who was out is still half a descendant from an Avraham or a Yitzchak. So Esav grew up in the home of Yitzchak. His grandfather was an Avraham. Says Rav Hirsch, this kiss and these tears show that Esav was also a descendant of Avraham. In Esav, there must have been something more than just a wild hunter. We know that that's what's defining him, is this ability to be the wild man and the hunter. But there must be something more, says Rav Hirsch. Otherwise, how could we have had the ability to domineer?
How could he
have had the ability to domineer the whole development of mankind, which the Romans actually did? The sword alone, simply raw force, is not able to do that. Who are we up against in our exile? We're up against an Esav. And an Esav does not simply represent, says Rav Hirsch, power and force. Power and force alone can't take over the world. Can't introduce a new culture, a new way of addressing the world, looking at the world, manipulating the world as Western civilization has done. But Esav also, gradually more and more, lays the sword aside, turns gradually more and more towards humaneness, and it is just Yaakov on whom Esav has most opportunity to show that and how the principle of humaneness begins to affect him. So first, there's a very poetic understanding that Western civilization will eventually move more towards humaneness. I think one can, again, without oversimplifying, basically document that when you look at Roman civilization, which was a civilization of gladiators, of feeding slaves and convicts to the lions and to the gladiators, a civilization of left-handed children or mentally unstable children literally being left on hilltops to die. When you look at that civilization, which was the preeminent civilization, most advanced civilization, and we would look at it as completely barbaric, to where we are now in the development of Western civilization, I think one would agree with what Rav Hirsch is saying, that the ace of dominion of the world has indeed progressed more away from the sword towards humaneness. Is the sword still a major component? Is might still a major... Absolutely. Absolutely. But certainly the country that we are being hosted by here in America is probably the most ideal as far as values of human decency, rights, are all moving far away from the original Roman beginnings into a much more humane society. Is society there? No. But it's much better now than it was then. Says Rav Hirsch, a very interesting idea. Where does that come from? It comes from because Esav was brought up in the house of a Yitzchak and was a grandson of an Avraham. Might alone, being a person of the sword, could not take over the world. It just couldn't. And so on whom does Esav demonstrate that he has this other element? On Yaakov himself, when he cries with him. When the strong respect the rights of the strong, it may well be wisdom. Listen to what he's going to say right now. You could have a society where strong respect strong. How would we define that? Humane or wise? He says that might be wisdom, that a strong person respects someone else who is strong. But it is only when the strong, as here Esav, fall around the necks of the weak and cast the sword of violence far away, only then does it show that right and humaneness have made a conquest. It's a beautiful poetic statement. The fact that I'll respect someone else and coexist with him, that might just be wisdom. I'm strong, you're strong, I recognize that it's in both of our best interests to lay the sword down and respect each other. That's wisdom. When I don't have to lay my sword down because I'm an equal to you, when I lay the sword down, when I can dominate you, but instead I respect you because you're weak, despite the fact that you're weak, that I become your protector, that is rightness and humaneness. And that's when rightness and humaneness will have made a conquest in the world. And again, in the society we live in, it's not only a Jewish thing. There are many, many, many non-Jewish organizations out there that excel in this concept. And that, says Rav Hirsch, is the element of the Avraham, and it's the progression of world society. But when you look back now over the Torah, when you read the lines that he just gave us, and you think back of the Torah, how does the Torah always, always, always phrase the responsibility of the Jew? Take care of the orphan and the widow and the stranger. The ger, the almana, and the yosom. Why? Because they don't have anyone. And therefore the Torah commands us, you are responsible for them. You cannot just say, whatever. Judaism means weak are taken care of by the strong, not the strong dominate the weak. And that is a new concept, and we're used to that, because even the country that we live in accepts that to an extent. Not fully, but to an extent. That might doesn't make right. That it's actually the responsibility of the might, because of their might, not to dominate, but to take care of those that they can. And that's why the Torah always repeats, again and again and again, that principle. It's a new concept. And you see here, in the tears of Esav, says Rav Hirsch, you see the idea that the humaneness, the idea of I'm stronger than you, I can annihilate you, I have my army of 400 men and you have nothing, and I cry instead of slaughter. Very interesting approach, says Rav Hirsch. Let's move on, yeah? Verse 5, what's the response? Vayisoes einav vayaras hanashim ves hayiladim. Esav sees the women and the children and he says, Mi eila. Lach, who are these to you? Vayomar, Yaakov responds, Hayiladim asher chanon elokim esavdecha. The children are whom God has graciously given your servant. So we pointed out, as Rashi did, it was Ramban, I believe, that Esav sees, the Torah tells us, both women and children, and he asks, who are these to you? Presumably asking about both the women and the children. And Yaakov responds and says, the children are God's gracious gifts to me. So we saw, I can't remember if it was Rashi or Ramban, that he didn't even want to talk about, I think it was Ramban said, as a modicum of modesty, that he didn't want to overtly mention. Maybe there's a...
I think it was Ramban.
Yeah. So Rav Hirsch is going to say something here which I'm still struggling with fully understanding. Maybe together we can understand exactly what it is that he means. Verse 5 in Rav Hirsch, bottom of page 511. In his reply, Yaakov speaks only of the children. And as this is a reply also to the question about the women, so he's asking now, since Esav really asked about both, and Yaakov only responds about the children, he indicates with great delicacy how next to the grace of God, he has to thank his wives for the bodily and spiritual richness he possesses in these children. So he says, God gave them to me, and then he's also thanking, very subtly, that it's the women for whom he has to be thankful for their spiritual richness and the physical ability, that the physical possession that he has, children. The women are the mothers of his children. So I'm not sure what he means. I think Rav Hirsch means, by not answering the question directly, by saying, you ask me who are these, and I say, these are my children, that I'm implying that the women next to them are their mothers. And in so doing, I'm subtly mentioning that acknowledgement to them as the mother of... I'm just not sure exactly what he meant. I don't know, any thoughts?
Sounds good.
And so that somehow, in that he only addresses the children, he's subtly acknowledging he's thanking his wives for the bodily and spiritual riches of his children. Okay, let's move on. Okay, here's verse 6 and 7. This wouldn't refer to either. Why does he set up the order as he does? Why is it first the maidservants, then Leah, then Rachel? Now, to do so, let's read the psukim carefully. We're not going to appreciate this at all only on the English. I'm going to focus a little bit on the Hebrew just for a moment, so we'll appreciate it as much as we can. Here we go in verse 6. What happens now? So far in our story, we've had the actual meeting. Esav runs forward. He embraces him. He hugs him. He kisses him, and they cry. Esav asks, who are all these people? Yaakov says, these are the children that God has been gracious to me with. This is my family. And now the party, the women, the children, come forward and bow down to Esav. The way the Torah describes it is follows. Verses 6, Vatigashna hashvachos, the handmaids approached, Heina v'yaldehem, they and their children, Vatishtachavena, and they bowed down. In English, again, which is an accurate translation, the handmaids approached, they and their children, and they bowed down. Vatishtachavena, I believe, is a feminine form of the word that Hirsch is going to discuss. Vatigash gam Leah viladeha, then Leah and her children approached, vayishtachavu, and they bowed down. V'achar nigash Yosef v'Rachel, and then Yosef and Rachel came, vayishtachavu, and they bowed down. So as I've been trying to stress, you know, there are a couple of differences here. One is in the maidservants. We have the vatishtachavena. The language for bowing down is a vatishtachavena, and they bow down, as opposed to the vayishtachavu, and they bow down, of what happens in the next two, of Rachel and with Leah. We also find, when the maidservants come forward, the pasuk says, the pasuk identifies the maidservants twice. The maidservants and their children, handmaids approached, they and their children. That word they is extraneous. It should have just said, the handmaids approached with their children, which is what it says in the next verse when it describes both Leah and Rachel. Leah and her children approached, and Joseph approached, and Rachel, and they bowed. Here it says, and the handmaids approached, they and their children. So Rav Hirsch is going to take these small nuances and build a whole edifice out of it. Ready? Verse 6 and 7 in Rav Hirsch. Says Rav Hirsch, the general rule that when the predicate is governed by a masculine and feminine subject, whenever there's a verb taking place, and the person that it's describing is both male and female, meaning he and she both came and they bowed. So how should the "and they bowed" look? Should it be masculine in structure or feminine in structure when the object that it's defining is both man and female? The general rule is it takes the masculine form, but it does not apply here. It's not what happens. Because it says, and the maidservants with their children bow down, and the language, the grammar of, and they bow down, is a feminine form of bowing down, even though it's describing the handmaids and the children, which includes both men and both women, so it should have been a masculine form. In the very first verse, the predicate is in the feminine form. The verb of, and they bow down, was feminine. And more exact observation, says Rav Hirsch, which he excels in, it seems to disclose interesting noble traits, so that somehow this is going to be a hint to something, a certain trait, especially the whole noble, courageous self-control of Jewish women. So says Rav Hirsch, we're going to find in here a certain courageous trait indicative or ascribed to general Jewish women, who even in the most extreme danger hold themselves erect and remain outwardly composed, where the sex that calls itself the stronger loses its head. Meaning to say, this is going to be an indication of what we find often in Jewish history, that when crisis comes, the men who are supposedly, in his language, the one that call themselves the stronger sex, loses its composure, and it's the women, traditionally painted into the weaker role, is going to disclose noble, courageous self-control. So far, so good? Mm-hmm. How is that? How much must the women and children have been hearing during the last days of the bad uncle? Hirsch assumes in these last couple days as they're getting ready to meet Esav. So everyone's saying like, hey, Abba, the children must have been saying, why are we doing this? We divided up the camp, and then we prepared this. Like we're in the middle of traveling. Everything is great. We're one big happy family. And then all of a sudden, right? We got all this stuff going on. We got camps. We got moving. Daddy goes back to get the little vessels. Like, he comes back limping. He had a whole fight. What's going on, Abba? So Hirsch assumes, well, they must have begun to hear that they're about to meet up with the bad Uncle Esav. So how much of they must have been hearing about this Uncle Esav, and how much must it have been impressed upon them to behave before the dreaded one with an outward appearance of due humility? And how does Yaakov always address himself?
Servant.
Your servant, your servant, your servant. Even when he's talking to his servants about what they should say to Esav, he still never lets himself slip and say anything other than, you'll say to my master Esav, so does your servant say, always. So says Rav Hirsch, the women and the children must have been inculcated with this idea of humility before this dreaded one, who we're clearly afraid of, we're preparing for war, we believe he can annihilate us, that he can divide the camps into two, at least one should survive. And that's what we're getting ready for. Now, says Rav Hirsch, the shvachos, the maidservants, stepped forth, they and their children, and bowed low. That word they, why is it there? The mother, the otherwise quite superfluous Hena, that they and their children, specially stresses this, that they were the ones who humbly submitted themselves to bow, and hence vatishtachavena, the feminine form of bowing down, the mothers included and placed first. Through their whole origin and past, they were accustomed to bow before much less feared persons. Says Rav Hirsch, let's start with the shvachos, the maidservants. Why did the Torah stress that when they came forth, it was they and their children, stressing that it was they who came forth? And why is the language of the bowing down feminine? Because they knew what to do. They knew, had been brought up in the house of Lavan, that before people from whom you're supposed to respect or fear, even people far less than an Esav, that's what you do. You humbly submit yourself to him. So they came forward. We stress that it was they together with their children, and they led the charge of, let me show you how it's done. Vatishtachavena was a feminine form of bowing down. Because the maidservants, from their having been raised in the realm Lavan, knew naturally what it is that you do to humbly submit yourself before somebody who you have to fear. That's the maidservants. Then, continues the verse, Leah stepped forth, the noble, proud, self-conscious wife, the real mother and keeper of the household. Leah had a different perspective. Proud, self-conscious, keeper of the household. Leah does not bow down before an Esav. Leah was going to say, I should bow down before this person. I'm married to a Yaakov Avinu, mother of the 12 tribes of the Jewish people, mother of Yehuda, who's going to be a Melech, mother of a Levi, who's going to be the Kohen and the Levim, Reuven the Bechor. I'm going to bow down to an Esav, says Rav Hirsch. Wouldn't do it. Leah does not bow down before an Esav. The children do it. Vayishtachavu. The shift from the feminine vatishtachaven of the maidservants, which the bowing down was led by them, shifts to a masculine and they bow down. Where's Leah? Why is it any different? The first one was also a combination of mothers and male children, and here you have again a mother and a male children. They should have been the same, because this one was different. This one was the children bowing down. Leah doesn't do it, suggests Rav Hirsch. We'll read a little bit more and put it all together in how he's understanding this whole episode. Then Rachel and her child, she only has one child. In other words, the plural verb and they bow down by Leah makes sense because she had multiple children. She has six. So her six children come forward and they bow down, masculine form. Rav Hirsch suggests because she wasn't involved. The six children were. And then Rachel and Yosef come, and again we find the plural verb, except here the plural verb, if it's plural, must include Rachel, because there's only one child. It's only Yosef. Continues at first. Then Rachel and her child should have come to the fore, but Yosef protectingly steps in front of his mother as her knight. And Rachel, afraid that Esav would take offense, and now this young child has suddenly stepped before her, so to speak, to say, don't go near my mother. Rachel, afraid that Esav would take offense at that, quickly bows to disarm him, so that Yosef should also bow vayishtachavu. Because Yosef steps forward, he's not stepping forward and bowing down, he's stepping forward as, watch my mother. Rachel says, I don't need to start any scene over here. Rachel bows in submission, teaching Yosef that that's what you're supposed to do right now. And so both of them bow, and you get the plural vayishtachavu there in also. So I want to, this is really a novel approach that Rav Hirsch is suggesting, and I just want to go over it again, how he's seeing it. He's describing, now one can make an argument that almost this entire two-verse section is unnecessary. Yaakov comes, he bows down seven times. So, okay, fine. Esav greets him, hugs him, kisses him, they cry. Esav asks, who are these people? Yaakov says, they're my family. Esav then asks, what's with the gifts? Yaakov says, please take it. We skip the women bowing down him. How critical is it for us to know that the parties that he had divided them into, the maidservants and their children, Leah and her children, Rachel and her child, also came forth and bowed down? Maybe it is critical, maybe it's not so critical. We're actually going to see that the sages are going to say something very significant. Who's missing out of the 12 tribes?
Binyamin.
I mean, out of the 12 tribes, Dina is not listed here, but Binyamin, she was around, so maybe she was there, maybe she wasn't, we don't know. She was in the box. But Binyamin's not there. So Binyamin is the only tribe who never prostrated himself before Esav. So the sages are going to say, when the Beis HaMikdash is going to be rebuilt, that the Holy of Holies should be in the section of Binyamin, because Binyamin represents the tribe that is pure, so to speak, from ever having submitted himself to the first forces or personage of an Esav.
He wasn't born yet.
Correct. He's going to be born on the way into Eretz Yisrael, and that's when Rachel is going to die as he's born. So Rav Hirsch points out that even though we have these two verses, extraneous, not extraneous, we have this whole two-verse section describing, and then there are these nuances, that the maidservants came forth first, and leave the double language, they and their children, and a feminine form of bowing down. Then we have Leah and a masculine form of bowing down, and then Rachel, which is again a masculine plural form, except Rav Hirsch says each one of these three was different. The first one, which is a feminine form, was because the maidservants had become accustomed to submitting yourself to people even far less wicked or powerful or dangerous than an Esav. So that's what you do. You run into some male figure who you're a little bit afraid of, you bow down in humble submission. So the maidservants, feminine, led the bowing down. They knew to do so. They understood that that's what happened. And therefore the Torah hints at that by saying it was a feminine prostration. Then we switch to Leah to a masculine prostration, in which refers to these, not just that it became, but what's different, that it was only the boys. That Leah, the mother of these children of a Reuven and a Shimon and a Levi and a Hun and a Sachar, that I will not bow down to an Esav, and therefore it was only the boys and not Leah at all. In his poetic language, the Jewish woman does not submit herself to the tyranny of an Esav, no matter what. Then you have a third episode in which Rachel and her son come, and it's again plural, but this means it must have been Rachel. Rachel's different than Leah. Why isn't Rachel having that same fierce, strong lack of submitting oneself to something like an Esav? So the first, well, here it's because Yosef, little Yosef, had run in front of her.
How old is he?
Not too old. Because Binyamin's not born yet. He's not that much older. So I don't know if he's more than 10, 11, 12, maybe at most. So little Yosef runs in front of his mother to protect her, and Rachel sees in that he's going to be as a almost like a sign of battle protection, like, don't go near my mommy. So that Rachel bows down first to show and disarm Yosef. That's what you're supposed to do, and that's why you get the plural language there. Even though Leah did not bow down, Refersh understands that Rachel did to disarm Esau from that which her little son Yosef had done. So that's the building, so to speak, that Refersh constructs from these psukim, based on the little nuances of language. He then concludes, and I'll take any comments or questions as we read this next to the line. What's the order for, says the first, not just to say that the maidservants were the least liked, so they went first, and Rachel was the most liked, so she went last. I could explain, based on what I just said, another reason for the order. Therein the motive for arranging the order of their approach may also lie. Yaakov let the maidservants go first because he could quietly reckon on their behaving with due humility. He knew they would do what he needed them to do. The maidservants, having been raised in the house of Lavan, he knew what was going to happen is that they would humbly submit themselves and he wouldn't have any problems. Rachel and Yosef last because he expected the least from them to be able to humbly submit themselves. He was more aware of what Yosef was going to do and Yachat to save the day. So he put them last because he had the least expectation of what he was going to be able to assume would go smoothly as far as the humbling of the family in front of Esav. Novel approach, that's how Refersh understands this particular element. Verse 8, Pasuk Ches. Vayomer mi lucha kol ha-machana. So Esav says, what is all this? Who is all this? Asher pagash. Vayomer lemtzochem b'nei Adonai, in order to find favor in the eyes of my Lord. Esav says, I have a lot, my brother, I have plenty. You keep whatever it is that you want. I don't need it. And then Yaakov responds why he begs Esav to accept it. Vayomer Yaakov al-noyim no matatzochem b'necha. No, please, if I found favor in your eyes, please take this gift from my hand. Because having looked at the countenance of your face is like looking at the face of, now we've seen until now, face of a god, and you have accepted me favorably, and refers and translates to here not as a god, but as a judge, correct. Therefore he begs in verse 11, take, I pray thee, my blessing which was brought unto you, for Hashem has graciously granted it to me, and I have everything. He pressed him, and he took. Okay, well, we pointed out, Refersh is going to focus on in verse 11, Yaakov says, please take my blessing. He refers to the gift, not just as a gift, which it was as a mincha, but specifically as a blessing. Says Refersh, Jacob averse, he begs, he pleads, he doesn't want to accept Esau's rejection. Says Refersh, at this moment I must recognize you as the moral and higher one of us, says Yaakov to Esau, that you have won a great victory over yourself, and I bow before that nobility. What I'm assuming he means, he doesn't say it explicitly, but I think what he means is, when you threw down your sword, when you had the ability with your might to annihilate me, and are now expressing your humaneness, as I first described earlier, that when might doesn't destroy the weak, but protects the weak, encourages, and guides them, that's a sign of nobility. And it sounds to me that that's what Refersh is saying. When Yaakov sees in Esav's response the tears, the true tears, the kindness that he's showing, now please, I don't need your gift, keep it for yourself, you need it. Yaakov says, at this moment, I must recognize that you are the moral and higher one amongst us, because you've expressed that ability of being the stronger one who is not taking advantage of that strength. Hey, he's a who gibor, and who's considered really strong? Hakovesh Yitzhar, one who has that self-control. And you have won a great victory over yourself. He doesn't say you've won a great victory over me, but you have won a victory over yourself. Rav Hirsch understands Yaakov is saying, and I bow before that nobility. Before somebody who is stronger, who has the ability to destroy, the ability to attack, and doesn't, I recognize that by bowing before you, that nobility. Bechora and Bracha, firstborn rights and blessings, were the two points which had kept them apart. Those were the two things that Yaakov took from Esav. He bought the birthright, and he swindled the blessing. Yaakov now expresses himself about both. Regarding the Bechora, regarding the rights of the firstborn, the spiritual moral factor, which was, we've seen, what was the rights of the firstborn? To be the spiritual leader of the family. He gives his brother in the mincha, his homage, acknowledging the nobility of his mind. When I give you a mincha, when I give you a gift, I'm acknowledging the nobility of what you are and who you represent. Regarding the bracha, and regarding the fact that I stole the blessing, he points out that he has drawn absolutely no material advantage. I really don't have anything over you. The riches which he has have been granted to him by God, who had blessed the work of his hands, and far more than that he has no desire. And for more than that he has no desire. I don't need anything else. So he has atoned for both. So the first season, this dialogue in which Yaakov begs Esav to take the gifts, he's sort of downplaying the two things that he would think that Esav is angry about. The moral character, because I have the firstborn status, and to that he says, seeing your face is like seeing the face of a judge. You are so noble right now in that you have the ability to conquer and you don't. I humble myself before that. And so, even though I bought the Bechorah from you, I acknowledge and am trying to atone for that fact by acknowledging you as a moral superior. And as far as the actual blessings go, which I took, I don't need anything else. The things that I have been given to me by God, and I'm not interested in anything else. You keep that which I've sent you. I don't need anything more. And in so doing, he's trying, Rav Hirsch says, to atone for both these two issues, the Bechora and the Beracha, the firstborn and the blessing. Okay, we'll stop here. We'll finish up, God willing, next week. A little bit more to do. And then we'll see where to take it from there.
For those of you who do catch up online with this class, and if you access it through Torah Media Atlanta, you should be aware that Yisrael Killian, who runs Torah Media Atlanta, reached out because donations to that site are down. Those of you who do take advantage of it, I would suggest making a donation online when you do use it so that he can continue that site.